Good morning. Welcome back to organizational behavior. And today we will talk about groups in organizations. And groups in organizations are so important. It's a cornerstone of organizational life. Most life in organization does not happen in the organization as large, but in the organization in their smaller departments, divisions, teams and work groups. And next week we will talk about teams, and there are some differences in the formal descriptions between or formal definitions of teams and groups, but please see the group and team session as a unity, because they both, of course, relate very closely to each other. Today we will be talking more about the fundamentals of group work, and I provide you a lot of definitions. But first, let's talk about last week's multiple choice questions. Last week, I remember there was a pretty dense session on motivation with a surprising end at the end. I hope you read all the slides, and now you know how to implement motivational theories to organizational practice when you, for example, design reward systems. I also provided you the little email that was sent to Google to Microsoft employees about their changing their reward systems. And this is a very important topic in organizational practice. You can do a lot wrongly with defining reward and bonus systems not appropriately. You can disappoint more people than you can satisfy people and make them happy. So it's very important to carefully consider the empirical evidence that is there for how can we best reward people, what is motivating for people, how can we satisfy individually different needs, and these things. And my advice to managers often is, if there is empirical evidence, then consider it, ideally meta-analysis. If there's no meta-analysis, then look at single studies that have been done in the area or in the sector where your organization is doing business in. And when this is not possible, then try to do a little experiment yourself. So for example, when you want to introduce a new bonus system, don't introduce it to the organization as a whole, but introduce it in one team or in one department or in one location of the organization and see how it works and see whether it has any side effects. And if appropriate, then roll it out or modify it and transfer it to other areas of the organization. Okay, so motivation can be defined by three key terms: intelligence, experience, intensity, experience, or knowledge. It's one of these three key elements. And it is the element most of us focus on when we typically talk about motivation. Paul took to own. Intensity. What were the other two elements, Moritz? Yes? Direction and persistence. And without direction, intensity is not useful. And direction and intensity are important parts of motivation, but persistence is also a very important part of motivation. In academia, for example, every doctoral student, every postdoc, every professor is highly motivated to publish. Publications are the number one criterion against which our individual and group performance is measured. So we are all highly motivated to publish. And we put in a lot of intensity. Typically, 20, 30, 40% of our time is focused on writing papers and sometimes books. Direction is another problem. Sometimes, where direction comes into play, the problem starts. Because we often write without knowing for which audience do we write. What is our target journal? When I start writing a book, do I already have a publisher? Do I know for which audience I will write my book? And only if I can answer these questions, if I have a target journal in my head, then the intensity will translate in some outcome that is appropriate for this journal. Otherwise, I write and write and write a lot of text, but the journals may not be interested in it. And persistence is one of the most important aspects of academic writing. So you have to cope with the fact that your papers get rejected by many journals. Often we submit papers to a journal, then it takes 3, 4, 5 months, and then it is rejected. Then we submit it to the next journal, and it is again rejected. And often we get 2 or 3 reviewers with long lists of comments, and most of them are very critical. And the top journals, like Journal of Applied Psychology, Academy of Management Journal, reject about 98% of all papers submitted there. So sometimes it takes a year, sometimes it takes 2 years before what we write gets published. So the number, probably from the three elements, the most important aspect of motivation in academia is persistence. Don't give up. Don't give up when you receive these critical comments, but see the positives in it and try to revise and amend your work so that it is more successfully received by the next journal. Okay? Intensity, direction, and persistence. McLellan's theory of need concentrates on which three needs? Yes, please.
Achievement, power, and affiliation.
Achievement, power, and affiliation. What may I ask you, which two of these three are important for leaders?
Power and achievement.
Thank you. And affiliation, the need for affiliation for leaders typically is lower than average or not particularly high, because if leaders are too much driven by affiliation, by an affiliation motive, they consider harmony and low conflict most important. But often leadership is about managing conflict and sometimes even instilling conflict to end up with more creative solutions. With reference to job characteristics model, which of the following defines skill variety? The degree to which a job requires completion of a whole and identifiable piece of work. Moritz, what's number A in the job characteristics model?
Number A, I can tell you what the answer.
Okay, tell me.
It's A, the degree of work to which, no?
No, the answer is not A. What is the answer? So, skill variety is the degree to which a job requires a variety of different activities. So when I'm on the assembly line of a car manufacturing company, and I always only fit the right front wheel, then there's extremely low skill variety. There's not a lot of my skills used to do that. When the assembly line, however, is organized in a way that teams of people fit the whole body of the car, and on Mondays I fit the wheels, and on Tuesdays I fit other parts of the car, then I need different skills. And that, according to the model and according to a lot of empirical research, is more motivating. What would be number A in terms of the job characteristics model?
Task identity.
So do I do a task where I see a whole and identifiable piece of work? This is, for example, school teachers who only teach one subject in a class do not see the whole student as much as a teacher who teaches 7 or 8 different subjects and sees the same students 20 hours a week. And I sometimes do not understand why primary schools do not organize their work as much as they could around the class as a whole and identifiable piece of work teachers can do. Some schools do that, where one teacher takes over the newcomers, the year one students, and then teach German and math and at least one other subject so that they see them every day and 2 or 3 hours a day. and follow them through until year four, until they leave school, because then they see and treat the students more as a unity, as an identifiable piece, and they have more task identity if they only see the students for 2 hours a week. What would be number B? Yes, please.
Task significance.
And task significance, if we consider our job meaningful to other people, if we perceive our task when we do it well as significantly positive, and when we not do it well, will significantly negatively influence the lives of the other people, then we have a greater sense of meaningfulness, and this translates into higher work motivation. In some analyses say that meaningfulness is the most important part of it. And this is also an element that has been picked up by positive psychology. So it's one of the pillars of positive psychology that says we should take care about every employee having some meaning in their job. And remember Viktor Frankl last week, who also considers meaning in life as the most important goal we should all strive for, and maybe the most fundamental need we all have. And managers can do a lot to make a task more significant by telling them why it is necessary that they clean the floor at NASA headquarters to help landing a man on the moon, etc. Any questions to last week's session or in general? We are already halfway through, so today lecture 7, and there are 7 more to go before the exam. You can all take all the material with you to the exam, so no need to worry, no need to be anxious. If you check the textbook chapters along the slides and take some notes, you will all be fine. Today we will be talking about groups. We start with the definition of groups and also about some differentiation we can make between different types of groups. And then I talk about models of group development. We talk about some characteristics of groups, such as norms, status, roles, role ambiguity as well. And then we talk about group decision making. And I have I find very interesting exercise where you start working individually and then continue working on it as a group, and then we can discuss the strengths and the weaknesses of getting people together to make decisions. And we also talk a little bit about culture. So what is a group? Two or more individuals interacting and interdependent who come together to achieve particular objectives. I will talk about this next week again when we talk about teams. Because for teams, and I already mentioned this, I think, in lecture 1 when I talked about the NHS research of Michael West and colleagues, who show that teamwork lowers patient mortality or reduces patient mortality in hospitals. And this is the definition that Michael West and their colleagues would put forward to define a proper team in organizations. In social psychological terms, we have typically an easier approach to define groups, and we say a group is a collection of people who define themselves as a group. And individuals can think and act as group members even when no one is around, even when there is no direct interaction with others. And in organizations, we see more and more groups, virtual teams, for example, or sales teams who are spread across different regional areas, who have very little face-to-face interaction. And next week, we will consider the factors that can still contribute making this team a good team or a good group. So this is a definition that describes both a group and a team in the proper sense, and we can differentiate between formal groups and informal groups. Formal groups are provided by the organization's chart. They typically have a leader, assigned leader or a legitimate leader. We can call this a command group. For example, the department within the university. The organization structure is that we have the president and the vice presidents, and below that the deans who lead the departments, and below the department level we have institutes of psychology, sports sciences, etc. And these institutes are led by directors. So that's the organization's chart, and that's the formal command groups that we can look at when we talk about groups and do research in organizations. We can also look, however, at task groups. So for example, when we form a group in our department about bachelor or master's accreditation, and we get a couple of people together to prepare the accreditation, three professors, two postdocs, and two students, and this group regularly meets, and it may have a leader, it may not have a leader, depending on the type of group. So for many groups, we elect a leader. For other groups, for example, our PhD committee is led by the dean per appointment or per regulation. So these task groups may or may not have a leader. They are also formal groups in the organization's sense that they are defined by the organization, but they have different purposes than command group. They come together to work on a specific task, and once this task is completed, the group can disband. And also group membership can change. For example, in the PhD committee, we can elect different members every 2 years if we like, or we can elect new student members when new students come in and existing students complete their studies and leave the group. Whereas the command group more or less is a fixed group in the organization's chart and hierarchy, completely irrespectively of its members. We can distinguish these formal groups from informal groups. For example, interest groups. In our department, we have a group of postdocs who share the same interests for playing football, and they meet once a week to play football together. This would be an interest group. Or a reading circle across different departments in our institute. So when General Psychology 1 and 2 and Biopsychology decide, let's meet once a month and discuss the latest research published in Psychological Science. This is neither a command group nor a task group. It's not defined by the organization. It's out of the interest of its individual members to attain a specific objective or align shared interests. And finally, we have friendship groups. Members have one or more common characteristics. So typically, in a university, you may find the group of Eintracht Frankfurt supporters. So they have the common characteristics that they all support the same team. And they, on Monday mornings, they discuss the results of the place at weekend. And sometimes they may even go and watch a match together. Both interest and friendship groups can be good for the organization's life because it helps gaining organizational cohesion. It makes people more happy when they go to work and also know that there are some people who they are friends with and share the same interests with. But the organization typically does not get involved in these groups' activities, nor can the organization appoint leaders or anything else. But typically for organizations, it's good to have these groups. Interest groups may also be good because they may align their holiday schedules. The organization cannot say across a command group or we form a task group for aligning everyone's holiday schedules. But interest groups can do that more easily. And this is then good for the organization because it takes away some of the work that otherwise the leaders would need to do. Okay. Why do people join groups? There's a number of reasons why people join groups. We can go back to evolutionary psychology. I told you already a few times that we have learned to live together in groups for 100 and 200,000 years, and it was necessary to achieve our goals. To kill the wildebeest 100,000 years ago, to provide security for its individual members. And today it's not necessarily about food and security, but it's about similar things We just call them differently. So goal achievement in modern organizational groups is about a sales goal or a performance goal. And we want to achieve this goal because we want to live a good life and earn our money, earn our salary. We want to have security at work. Workplace safety, for example, is still an important reason, and it's sometimes important to join groups to make sure that workplace safety and security is given. Unions, for example, are a group that many people join because then they feel more safe and secure against the organization exploiting them or firing them without reason. And they know I can trust my union that they will support me when I have any conflict with my boss, supervisor, organization. We sometimes join groups because we think it's good for our status, particularly, of course, if it's high status groups. So people in organizations may work towards promotion, being promoted to a managerial level, because managers often have a higher status than non-managers. And this satisfies our individual self-concept and self-esteem needs. We join group because we have a deeply rooted need for affiliation. When we talked about McClelland, the need for affiliation is just one of several needs, but everyone has a need for affiliation that can vary on certain level, but there's no single individual who does not have a need for affiliation at all. No one likes being isolated. No one likes being rejected by others. Everyone has some need for affiliation, and some have a stronger need and others less so. And sometimes groups can satisfy our needs for power. If we are many, then we are more powerful. If we belong to a powerful, high status group, we can also exert our individual needs for power more effectively than when we are on our own. Okay, so that's some basic definitions of groups and which groups we can distinguish and why we join them. So what happens when we have joined groups? And there are at least two major models. The first model or group of models is a sequential model, and the other model is a more flexible way of thinking group development. And I will show you two classic models. The first one is Tuchman's model. This is one example of a sequential group development model. And it's one of the more famous ones that have also been scrutinized by researchers. It comprises five stages. The first stage is called the forming stage. Here, group members try to get to know each other. Remember when you first came to Frankfurt to study your master's program in the first week of orientation, for example, or when you came into this class for the first time and you had to decide where to sit. Some of you are new to Frankfurt and didn't know many people. Others have already studied here in their bachelor's and did already knew a few more people. But typically in every group that comes together for some purpose, we have this stage where we try to get to know each other. Often this comes with uncertainty, with a lot of uncertainty. We don't look into the other's eyes. We sit somewhere or stand somewhere and subtly monitor the other people's behavior and try to see what they do because we don't know anything about the organizations or the group's norms and values and ways of doing things and processes. So we try to establish a common understanding in this phase. And managers have to understand that this is an inevitable and important stage of group development. So for example, when I form a project group or a new team, I have to consider that every group of people that is new needs this stage to get to know each other. And we have to make room for this, and we have to allow people to talk to each other. Therefore, we have these orientation weeks in the bachelor programs and in the master programs. And typically it's good When we, for example, start a new project, it's good to have a kickoff meeting with every individual in this project involved. I had to learn this a couple of years ago I had the good opportunity to learn this a couple of years ago. Our staff development center has just appointed a professional project manager to provide coaching for scientific projects. And I heard about this at exactly the time when we had been awarded a relatively large research grant. And so I invited the project manager to look into our application and see what we were about to do. And then he suggested to do a kickoff meeting. I didn't think about this before because it was clear to me that one of our team members, who also has written the application, was responsible for executing the project. And I thought it was okay for her just to start. But the project manager told us, no, it's important to have a kickoff meeting with everyone involved. The secretary who may do the office business, student research assistants who would not know about the project before they were given specific tasks, you as the project coordinator or leader, and maybe think of other people that are relevant. And it's also good to have a bottle of champagne at the kickoff meeting and celebrate that you are now together to work on this important project, this important topic. So we did this team kickoff meeting with the 5 or 6 people involved, and I think it greatly helped, at least for some of the research assistants who were new to our team at that time, but also our secretary, who, because of this kickoff meeting, not only got to know the other team members a little more, but also got to know about the purpose of the whole project. So it's good to allow some time for the forming stage. And often managers do not know this and ignore this, and they think they can jump right into the middle of the action. The second stage, the storming stage, is characterized by conflict. Here, group members are torn between two motivations. On the one hand, they want to join the group and they are happy because it satisfied their affiliation needs, etc. And if it's a high status group, and then it also satisfied their needs for status and power, etc. But on the other hand, a group also always means that I have to give up at least some of the control that I normally would like to have as an individual, because now it's the other group members, it's the group norms, it's the group leader, blah, 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 who defines my daily schedule, or which defines what I have to do, etc. And it's also characterized by conflict, not only between the individual and the group norms, but also between the individuals. For example, when it's a group that does not have an officially appointed leader by the organization. So there may be some conflict about who is the leader. And if it's a group with an appointed leader, there's often some battles about informal leadership. So when I have a group with, on average, 30-year-old postdocs, and the youngest one is appointed the leader, because the organization thinks that this person has earned the highest amount of funding, there will certainly some battle of the older people who consider themselves as more appropriate to be leaders. And this storming stage is also necessary. There are some studies that have shown that groups that never go through a storming stage are not as high performing as groups who went through a storming stage at some stage of their group's development. So it seems to be necessary that at some time in the group's development, there's some debate, there's some conflict, because only when there's a debate in the next stage, the norming stage, we can set the rules and norms and goals. When there's never a debate, then the group norms and the purpose, etc., are never brought to the open, are never clearly and explicitly are formulated. This is also the phase where the group members develop close ties to each other, develop friendship and camaraderie, and then we can start performing. And this is only the fourth step in the five-stage model. Managers often think, okay, here's a group, start. And managers underestimate that it takes time to get there. And managers can do a lot to manage these stages appropriately, make sure that these stages are there, and then manage these stages appropriately by, for example, appointing an external person who helps orienting the people and moderates when there's too much conflict and keeps track of the norms and goals and standards that have been developed in the norming phase and puts it somewhere on a flip chart, for example. And then in many groups, we have an adjoining stage. So groups who are not together permanently, like an accreditation group, for example, that may work together for 3 or 4 years. But then when the accreditation process is completed, the group will also disband. And this is a very important stage that is also often forgotten in practice. This is important because managers have to make sure that first they cope or they help individuals cope with negative feelings. I've worked with these people for 3 years. I've met them twice a week and we spent some good and some bad times together, but it became part of my organizational life and also part of my personal life. It became part of my own social identity, being member of this accreditation group. So when the group stops working from one day to the next, it leaves me with a little hole in my set of identities, and managers can contribute to help people coping with this. Like having a party at the end is something that may already help. Or when we talk about universities or companies, alumni circle are something that helps getting over the adjoining stage. So I know that I can meet my colleagues once every 2 or 3 years at alumni gatherings. Or I know that I can keep contact to these because the alumni circle will help me keeping track of their addresses, etc. Organizations more and more utilize this. You know that people have to work longer anyway, and organizations more and more are aware of the fact that they sometimes have to refer back to people who are already retired. Herr Simon is an example of this. So organizations like universities are heavily reliant when there's a crisis situation, and for the last 4 or 5 years we have a crisis situation. We now have 46,000 students. When I started here 8 years ago, we had 32,000 students. So that's 14,000 students more. That's 40 to 50% more students than we had just a few years ago. So what we do is we try to convince people who are going into retirement to stay on a little longer. So for a couple of years now, we have the instrument of Seniorprofessuren. So professors who go into retirement and to say, okay, for a little more money, I will stay on another year and I'm happy to teach 2 classes or 3 classes as a senior professor. And this is not because Goethe University wants to be nice to old people. It's because Goethe University desperately needs the people because we have so many more students. And it's also a relatively cheap way of dealing with this crisis, at least for a short term. And large organizations more and more also are aware of this fact, and therefore they help forming alumni clubs for Deutsche Bank, for example. And more they consider the stage of retirement a necessary stage that they should be concerned about to help the people keeping a link with the organization so that their expertise can be drawn upon when needed. In the adjourning stage, it's also necessary to document what has been achieved. Accreditation, again, is a good example. So you may have a group of 10 people who work on the accreditation for 5 years. It's really sometimes a process as long as this. After these 5 years, the group disbands. And then the next accreditation starts 2 or 3 years ago, the re-accreditation process. Maybe two or three or four members of the group have already left the university because professors have gone into retirement or have been appointed at other universities. The PhDs or postdocs have completed their qualification and have left the university, and the students certainly will have left the university. So 3 years ago, 3 years on after the accreditation has been completed, it all starts anew, and maybe only few people from the original team are left over that can be used to form the new team, but it would be good to have some proper documentation to know about what the team, the previous team, has achieved and why, and what were the processes, and what are the necessary steps, and where were some stepstones that people want to take. So in the adjourning stage, the group and the management needs to make sure that there's proper documentation of what and why has been achieved. Generally, groups become more and more effective as they progress. So, of course, managers don't wait months or weeks until the group members start working. They may have an hour of getting introduced to each other, and then everyone expects that they start working. But then the conflicts will arise, and then the norms are defined. And while they are doing this, they work on their tasks. But in the earlier stages, they are probably not working, or they are likely to not work on the tasks as effectively as they do at later stages in the model. Some groups need conflict. Some groups are most productive in stage two. And as I said, for all groups, some conflict seems to be needed, so managers can spark some conflict by making innovative ideas or by challenging the team and then see what happens. Research has found that the general model that groups are more effective as they progress through the stages is true. The stages, however, are not always sequential. Tuchman's original model didn't have the red arrows in it, so Tuchman assumed that this was a linear way of working together in every group, but research has found that it's more likely that sometimes groups skip a stage but may go back to that stage at a later time. Sometimes a group is well performing, but then we have an external influence like a financial crisis. And this may create conflict in the group again about how to cope with the situation. And then there needs to be norming and new processes have to be defined. Sometimes it's internal developments in the group, such as group membership change or when the leaders change, that groups regress from the performing stage to earlier stages. So research has confirmed, yes, when the group progresses, it becomes more and more effectively. Yes, groups need to be conflict, and some groups more than others, and some are most productive in the conflict stage. But the stages do not need to be sequential. Sometimes multiple stages can be taken at the same time, and sometimes groups can regress a stage. Whew. Any question to Tuchman? Think about yourself in your life as a student. When was there forming stage, orientation week, maybe the whole first semester it took you to get to know the other people, then the storming stage. There were certainly also some conflicts, not only within the university, but also between you and your partners, your former friends, your parents, the people you live with. This all belongs to your life as a student. But after a while, you have understood the rules and you have agreed upon the standards with the people that you, for example, learn with together for exams. And after you completed your bachelor programs, the adjourning stage happened to all of you, But for some of you, it was a more extreme adjourning stage because you not only moved from your bachelor program to a new stage, the master program, but you also changed cities, changed circle of acquaintances and friends, etc. Now, this is the Tuchman's model, or the model, these type of sequential models typically apply to relatively permanent groups. Groups that are together for at least some months or years and work together. But we have a lot of much shorter termed groups. We have many of these short-term groups in organizations. Project teams that are together for only a few weeks or even a few days. And you are certainly aware of these short-term groups in your student's life cycle. Like maybe you form a group of learning for the organizational behavior exam with two or three friends. And you may think, okay, we will start end of January or mid-January, and the exam is mid-February, so we have about 4 weeks' time. Within these 4 weeks, certainly some elements of Tuchman's model apply. So there will be some discussions, particularly when you are new to Frankfurt and when you work with people you haven't worked before in your bachelor programs. There will be some conflict, and there will be some norming necessary. Who will do which type of work? Who will take the lead when there are problems? Who is the coordinator who always aligns meetings, etc.? What do we do when someone is late for a meeting? What do we do when someone does not deliver what they are supposed to prepare for the next meeting? So Tuchman's model also applies for a group that may be only together for 4 weeks and that disbands as soon as the exam is completed. But also other models apply to these short-term groups. And the most famous model has been developed by Connie Gersick. Connie Gersick is more a qualitative researcher. In the late 1980s, she has observed many groups in organizations, in voluntary organizations, in for-profit organizations, in all or many different areas of sectors and industries. And she observed a striking similarity across these different groups. And she called her model the punctuated equilibrium. Gersick. Punctuated equilibrium model. Complicated term, very simple thing. T1 is a deadline. You know the 19th or 20th of February, there will be the exam. That's a deadline. Or think about the last time you and two or three other students had to give a presentation in a seminar. So you exactly know from the first day of semester when is the deadline and who are the others I will do with the presentation with. And this is T0, so this is where you get the assignment or you know these are the other two I will start learning for the exam with. What Gersick found is very interesting. Almost every group follows the same principles. There's hectic activity at the beginning. So you do something, you feel energized, you exchange material, you promise that you will do a lot of work together and that you also will have fun together, and you, right after the seminar, you go for a coffee and exchange your notes and try to agree on a roadmap, etc. But then it stalls, and not a lot is happening, and you all know this. This is what we typically do. We forget about the exam, or we forget about the presentation that we have to give. And it seems such a long time from now. So what do we have now? late November, the exam is in February. Come on, that's another year. That's 2015. And most groups follow this pattern. So this little bit of hectic activity at the beginning is not followed through. It would be good if it were. It would be much better, but that's apparently not how we work. And Gerzig found that exactly T1 half, exactly at the in the middle between the starting point and the deadline, there's hectic activity again. For some reasons, I don't know, but I've observed this a lot of times when I was teaching at Aston. Our students in the first lecture were always given an assignment to come together in groups, work towards a presentation in these groups in every lecture, and then give this presentation in lecture 7. And there was a lot of questioning on the first lecture, and sometimes as a lecturer I received evenings in the same afternoon or at night from some students who were double-checking whether they have understood the assignment correctly, etc. And then you didn't hear anything from the students anymore. But then at week 3 or 4, hectic activity for some reason seems to have kicked in, and I started receiving emails again. So what was it about again? I forgot the password, forgetting the materials, can you please, etc. And then it starts again, and then there is some hectic activity at the very end. You know that. This is a night before the deadline. This is a night before you have to submit the coursework, etc. And this is how we humans seem to tick. Not dependent on whether we do it in the Red Cross or in Deutsche Bank, not dependent on whether we are students or whether we are experienced project team workers. The good news is for the somewhat neurotic group members and the somewhat neurotic team leaders, there will be a result for almost every team. And it will be good because these three stages seem to suffice for obtaining the goals of this team. If you are neurotic and you find yourself somewhere here or somewhere here, don't be too concerned. There will be hectic activity here and there, and that is enough to get the goals achieved. The bad news, however, as you can imagine, is this causes a lot of stress. You all know that the night before submitting some coursework, your bachelor's thesis or so, it's not a very pleasant night. Yes, it's a good feeling when you have survived the night and submitted everything, but wouldn't it be so much better if you would do it over 2 or 3 or 4 nights with 2 or 3 extra hours than rather than working 12 hours round the clock to get it done? Wouldn't it be so much less stressful if we had a linear progression towards achieving the goal? And maybe telling people about this model already helps sometimes being a little bit aware of this is how we work, and if we would let go, we would achieve our goals. But if we would remind our team members, and again, when I told you about personality, I told you that sometimes it's good to have a neurotic person in the team. Maybe the neurotic person is reminding their team members of the deadline and maybe contributing to the fact that it goes a little bit more smoothly than with these sharp interruptions. So this is Connie Gerzig's model, and I think this is also a relevant model to know and an interesting model. Yeah, I briefly want to talk about group properties, briefly want to talk about roles, norms, status, size, and cohesiveness, and then I move on to group decision making, and I have an, I think, very interesting exercise with me, and it will take time, so I try to make this a little shorter now. Roles are the set of expected behavior patterns that are attributed to occupying a given position in a social unit. Sounds quite complicated, but you all know what roles are. You know what the leader is expected to do. When it's a meeting, yesterday our director chaired an Institute of Psychology director's meeting, and we all know what he is expected to do. He is the one who we expect to open the meeting and to guide us through the agenda and to say stop when we over-exceed our time, etc. This is our view of how we and others are supposed to act in given situations. So, for example, when time limits are exceeded, or when there's conflict, or when people talk during the meeting or come late. And sometimes there's role conflict between what we believe we should do and what others believe we should do, and sometimes also role conflict about we having different roles. So as a dean, for example, I may have the role to take care of the institute's or the department's budget, and with my head as head of the social psychology department, my goal is to have as many staff working with me on achieving our goals simultaneously as possible. And when a group member leaves, then there's some conflict. On the one hand, I would like to fill this position again as quickly as I can. On the other hand, as a department chair, I may think, oh, it's good when someone in the social psychology department leaves and we only appoint a successor half a year later, then we save 6 months of salary. And sometimes these roles are in conflict with each other. And that doesn't feel good. Norms are acceptable standards of behavior within a group that are shared by the group's members. And they are powerful means of influencing behavior. It can be norms for appearance. We talk about this when we talk about culture a little more, how groups can make us dress very differently than we would normally dress if it were completely up to us. So you are not sitting here with suit and tie because you, as students, have an understanding of what is appropriate to wear. But if you would work in a different context, that would look completely different. At Aston University, I had to learn to wear suit and tie because often my students were wearing suit and tie because they were part-time working MBA students who just came from work or had to leave the class right afterwards to go to work. And this made the whole norms for appearance for lecturers a little different than it is here in Germany. And let's talk about performing norms in a little bit more detail. Did I tell you about the Hawthorne studies already? Hawthorne, electrical plant, Mayo, did I? With the light switched down and switched on again?
But you mentioned them before.
Yeah. So in the Hawthorne studies, Mayo, Roethlisberger, Dixon, and so on found that the groups themselves set the norms for appropriate performance. It's typically not maximum performance that groups go for, but it's appropriate performance. And people who overexceed the group norms for performance were called rate busted and were penalized by their colleagues. I worked on an assembly line very similar to what Roethlisberger and colleagues studied at the Hawthorne plant with the women working in the relay room. I worked at Siemens checking telephones as a summer job. And I worked there with Croatian women, all Croatian women. And I very quickly realized that we could do the job much faster. And then the women told me to please stop doing that because they needed the little buffer between appropriate and maximum performance to allow themselves some time for having a cigarette a little more often than the supervisors would like, or to cope with the fact that some women were simply not feeling well at some days and making up for their on average lower performance, etc. And from research on conformity, this is now again basic social psychology. Groups in which a person is aware of other members defines themselves, him or herself, as a member, and believes the group members to be significant. This is what we call reference groups. And when we are members of reference groups and we identify with these groups, we like these groups, and we do what is normative in these groups, and we try to conform to this. And Ash has shown that this even goes to compliance, although we clearly realize and know that the group is wrong. Remember the line experiment by Ash? So people were brought into the laboratory, they were shown a standard line and three comparison lines, and their very simple task was to identify one of the three comparison lines that would match the length of the standard lines. And in control groups, there was no single error or almost no single error. But in the real groups, where this is a participant and the others are research confederates, and the confederates of the experimenter always gave the wrong answer, the real participant looks puzzled. He does not know what he needs to do because he feels that the others are wrong. But at the same time, he has the drive, the motivation to comply with what the others say, because it doesn't feel good to be against the majority view. That's, of course, not always the case. We sometimes do not comply with group norms when it's in the area of criminal, illegitimate, or unethical behavior. We do see that people raise voice and do something against it sometimes. And often we comply because it's good. So Ash was showing that sometimes we comply with others' behavior that is wrong. But of course, most of the time we comply with group norms that are there for a reason and that are related to good performance and that are in the best interest of the organization, its customers, and its members. So that it is good that groups develop norms and that highly identified group members follow these norms. But sometimes this can go wrong. Deviant workplace behavior. We talked about Frau Derwall stealing pens. Where's Frau Derwall now? Yeah, was it pens? Ah, now it's on video again. Can.
No, I wasn't stealing, I was raising my hand and you asked me this question. I was like, stealing, and I didn't know what you were asking. I was like, yeah, I was stealing pens, but.
You didn't steal pens. Good, so we have it on record. Frau Derwall did never steal any pens. Good. But stealing pens would be deviant behavior on a really low level. And almost always everyone is doing it because many groups develop norms that this is okay. So the norm in the group is, yeah, we do a lot of work and we take our work back home, so it's okay that we also can take a pen or some other material to get our work done in the evening. And that may be perfectly okay, may even be sanctioned by the organization, positively sanctioned when we would ask for it. But in many other situations, this is of course not okay. And deviant behavior can go as far as sabotaging the organization, destroying property, destroying material, accusing the organization in public. And this is called deviant behavior. Often some behavior is seen as deviant, although ultimately it's good for the organization. So sometimes it's a question whether deviant behavior may eventually benefit the organization or not. But typically, it is defined as voluntary behavior that people show, which violates significant organization's norms and threatens the well-being of the organization and or its members. And this happens more likely when people work in groups and when there are group norms for showing this deviant behavior. Unions, for example. From Deutsche Bahn's point of view, train drivers not driving trains is a deviant behavior. And they do it more or less on a voluntary basis. They vote for going on strike or not. So it's in a way voluntary. it threatens important organizational norms for we provide reliable transport for our customers. Ultimately, it threatens the well-being of the organization as such, because many people during the strikes have left Deutsche Bahn and taken Fernbus companies, etc. And eventually, it would also threaten the well-being of its organizational members. Why do so many train drivers go on strike? Because they are organized in groups, which we call unions. And because unions have their own group norms, that in this case, this deviant behavior is a perfect thing to do. And it's justified by their arguments. Status is a socially defined position or rank given to groups or its group members, typically by others. I cannot say as an individual, I'm a high status member. Status is mostly assigned by others who perceive a certain group of being as high status. And it's determined by a power a person or a group can wield over others. Typically, senior managers have more power over others lower down in the organization's hierarchy. By a person's ability to contribute to a group goals. The best player of Eintracht Frankfurt has more power because he has a higher ability to contribute to winning matches than players who are not so able. And other individual personal characteristics. These personal characteristics, for example, can be physical characteristics. Typically, we associate power or status with physical characteristics such as body size. Taller people are seen as having more power and status than shorter people. People talking with a deep voice, with a low voice, are typically assigned higher status than people talking with a less deep voice. Intelligence is a personal characteristic that makes us more powerful and be seen as of higher status, for example. High status for individual members is good. They often have more freedom to deviate from the group norms. The most powerful person can afford to be not perfectly aligned with the group norms. They are also typically more resisting peer pressure. And the interaction of the team members is influenced by the levels of status. High status people can be more assertive people, can be more assertive than low status people. Low status members may not feel the desire to participate in group activities as much because they feel that they are not so important for the group. And group creativity may suffer when there are too many status differentials. So, yeah, we talk about group think later on, and one element of group think is when we have a strong, powerful leader and the other group members don't dare to challenge him or her. And the final property, smaller groups are typically faster at completing tasks. The members typically also perform better. Large groups are often better at problem solving. Maybe we can try this later on by having two or three smaller groups and one or two larger groups and see whether there's a difference. The larger groups get, the more likely we also see problems, for example, of social loafing or free riding. I think you know what social loafing is, that people slack off a little when they don't feel that their input is really necessary and that it is not identifiable what they individually contribute to achieving the group goals. Sometimes we say that when we engage in peer evaluation, that may be good, or when we increase intergroup competition, this may be good to overcome social loafing. Typically, we can overcome social loafing when we make the group important to its members. And we have done a study where we did just that. We invited teachers to our laboratory. It was all teachers from a school, from a real school, and we always invited them to the laboratory in groups of three. And in the first condition, and in all three conditions, we told them, we are working on a project of educating and training teachers how to better deal with disruptive student behaviors. So we will give you a few scenarios of disruptive student behaviors, such as mild forms of sexual harassment, or a teacher who observes a student who has a knife on the schoolyard. And we would like you to come up with ideas how to deal with this behavior, and then we use these ideas to create some manuals for future training programs. In all conditions, the teachers were all working individually on an individual computer. The scenarios were described on a monitor, and then they were asked to come up with their ideas, enter each idea into the computer, press enter, and then come up with the next idea. In the first condition, we had a so-called nominal group. We told the three teachers, please come into the laboratory. You will be seated in small cubicles, and please complete our little questionnaire and then come up with ideas. And in the questionnaire, we asked them for their identification with the group of three teachers they just entered the laboratory with. This is, in many brainstorming research, the typical nominal group. So the people don't interfere with each other, they don't really consider themselves as a group, but they are told and they know that we look at their individual contributions. So each one of you entered their idea individually, and we will identify the best ideas to be put in the manual. And this is a normal group condition in all brainstorming research. Same scenario, teachers also individually enter their ideas into a computer. This time, however, they are explicitly referred to as a group. And the experimenters tell these three people, we are not interested so much in your individual ideas. Every idea that you enter in this room goes into a pool of ideas of your group, and we will identify the best ideas. So the teachers are told they are a group, but they don't feel like a group. What they know is, oh, it's not any longer my individual contribution that matters, but the researchers will only look at the pool of ideas from my group. And what we typically find is that teachers in this group engage in social loafing because they don't see their individual contribution as important and identifiable anymore. They invest less time and effort and think less hard about good ideas than in this group. And what we argued in this research program, and we were among the first when we started doing this, now there are a few more studies that have confirmed and replicated our findings. We argued social loafing is not really inevitable and not necessarily happening. It depends on whether we make the group important or not. So in a third condition, we had three teachers who did the same task and who were also told, we are not interested in your individual contributions, but we will be taking your group's ideas, and from this pool of group's ideas, we will identify the best ideas to be put in a manual. The difference between the two group conditions, however, was that we seated these three teachers around a table so they could see each other, and we told them, we will compare the ideas of your groups with other groups. So we instilled some small belief of competition between groups. And this was both done, the seating and the comparison was done to raise people's importance of the group and their identification with the group. And this is what we found along our hypothesis. We found evidence for social loafing between the nominal and the first group condition. So significantly fewer ideas when the three teachers were doing the same task in the same setup, but were told we are not interested in your individual ideas, but in your group's ideas. But we found considerable more ideas and more ideas than in the control group when we told the teachers, we are not interested in your individual performance, but in your group's performance, but we made the group more important for them. We also measured teachers' identification, and we found that in this third condition, individuals' group identification was indeed high, higher than in the other two conditions. And when we performed mediation analyses, we found that identification mediated the effect of the condition on the outcome. So our argument is you can overcome social loafing best by making the group important and help people identify with their groups. Okay. Another construct closely related to identification is cohesion. It's typically measured very differently. So typically you measure about relations that every group member has with every other members, and when there are stronger links then you have a highly cohesive groups. But more or less cohesive groups are also groups in which more people identify and vice versa. And whether cohesive groups are more productive or not depends again on the group norm. When there is a norm for high productivity, then highly cohesive norms are also more productive. How can we gain cohesion or increase cohesion? By, for example, making the groups smaller. My own best estimate or best suggestion is have groups of 7 ± 2 members. 7 seems to be a good number because we can keep 7 elements of items in our memory, ±2. If groups get too large, then we can, particularly as a leader, not necessarily remember each and every group member. But of course, every group should have as many members as needed. For football, it's 11. Basketball, handball, it's fewer. But 7 ± 2 seems to be good advice to organizations. If it's more than 8, 9, or 10 members, then it's better to split the group. And now I would like to do the exercise. We should do it a little faster than said on the paper. So please, there are correct solutions. Imagine you got lost in the wilderness and now you have to survive. And here are 10 questions with 4 answer alternatives each, and you have to pick one answer individually. Everyone, please do that. But do it as fast as you can, so it doesn't really matter whether you are perfect at the end or not. First, everyone does it individually, and then I'm asking you to exchange your ideas as a group and also make a group decision about the correct answers. But first individually, try to do it within 5 minutes, please. difficult. Sie sind ja schnell. Gut. Okay, one more minute for the individual task. Ungefähr die Hälfte ist richtig. Ich sage aber nicht welche. Sind Sie fertig? Moritz, du wärst längst tot. Fertig? Du weißt doch gar nicht, was der Oriongürtel ist. Der Orionsbelt. Nicht sagen. Wer weiß, ob das stimmt. Okay, können Sie acht eine Gruppe bauen? Dann haben wir nämlich eine richtig große Gruppe. Können Sie vielleicht darüber gehen und dann machen Sie auch eine relativ große Gruppe? And now you have 5 minutes to work on a group task. So, with some discussion, but as fast as possible, agree upon a group solution. Silent observer. Also wenn ich jetzt was an den Folien ändern möchte, ohne dass die das mitkriegen, kann ich das irgendwie? Dann lassen wir es. Ja, nee, dann. Which question are you at now? On a group level? Where are you now? Question 6, 7, yeah, good. Und das ist jetzt schon Ihre Gruppenantwort.
Ja.
Also super Frage. Gut. Sind Sie noch bei A1? Question 1?
Yes.
Oh, you have to be a little bit faster. The others are with question 6 or 7. So you are about question 6, 7 for the group?
Mm-hmm.
5, okay. Was ist denn der Weberknecht? Nee, wie heißen die hier?
Das ist der letzte, haben wir eben festgestellt.
Der Harvestman. Harvestman. So, do you have a group solution already?
Good.
Okay. I think because, sorry, can I have your attention back, please? Because of the time is running out, I think we interrupt this here. And I'm giving you the right solutions now, and you can quickly compute your scores on an individual and on a group basis, and the groups that haven't made it until the final question. Just count the group average and the best individual average and so on the basis of the questions that you already managed. So the correct answers for question 1 is D. For question 2, it's D. For question 3, it's D or 4. For question 4, it's D again. For question 5, it's D. For question 6, it's D. D, always D. It's always D. But for question 7, there it's C. For question 8, it's D again. Question 9, it's B, the brown recluse. And for question 10, it's D again. And now please calculate the correct scores individually and identify the best individual and the group average. Haben Sie mitbekommen, alles richtig? Did you get the... Yeah. Und alle tot?
Ja, wir sterben allein und mit Gruppe.
Und als Gruppe?
Als Gruppe weniger.
Weniger?
Ich glaube schon.
Nee, mehr. Sieht doch noch ganz oft D aus. Ach so, nee, Sie haben...
Wir haben
das, was hier steht, ist das, was ich gesagt habe, ja.
Ich war, glaube ich, alleine. Habe ich 4 und in der Gruppe 3. Hatten wir in der Gruppe 3, oder?
Nee, 2.
Hä, echt?
Wo ist denn das dritte?
Wir
haben nur 6 ins richtig.
4.
7 haben wir richtig.
Die vierte haben wir auch richtig, oder?
Na gut, damit 3.
Okay.
Wer ist der beste individual in the group? Who's the best? Who had more than 4?
Wer hat denn 4?
Natalie.
2 or 3 have 4, some have 3. And the group's average is 3. Yeah. Well, the group's not the average, the group score. And the group's average would be 3 point something. Okay. So you, may I see? Group score is 3, 2.6, 4, yeah. May I check your... Two, three, four. Yeah. Thank you. So it was very nice. The outcome was the same in the three groups, and it apparently does not matter whether we have a really large group or whether we have two smaller groups. So on average, the group score was 3, the best individual was 4, and the average individual was something like 2 point something or 3 point something. So I think, I don't know whether I have it on some slide, but I wanted to say that typically in groups, here, the group is better than the average individual, but typically worse than the most accurate group member. At least when it's about tasks that have one correct solution and you have one or two individuals that are experts in the area where you work on. But when it is about speed, then individuals are typically faster than groups. When it's about creativity, groups often produce more creative solutions. And this is very important, when we define a solution after having had a group discussion and a group agreement, then the goals are typically also accepted on a higher level than when an individual makes this decision. But when we all take this together, individuals are faster. Typically, the best individuals make the most correct solutions better than the average group. Then when it's about efficiency, groups are typically less efficient. And the final thing I would like to mention today is groupthink. And you remember groupthink probably from social psychology. We talked about the classic Yannis book, who studied the Kennedy administration disaster of invading Cuba. And what has been found is that when there's strong leadership and the group feels a strong pressure from the outside, then we see often too much deviance and group members blindly follow what they think the other group members may think is the correct solution, and this often leads to disasters. There is one really interesting study in the German journal Umweltpsychologie about menschengemachte man-made environmental catastrophes, and the example is the Chernobyl catastrophe 25 years ago in Chernobyl, where the group of Ukrainian engineers felt like a very strong elite group. They came under immense pressure from the outside. They had strong leadership, and they didn't listen to the dissenting group members' arguments that they should run the experiment later, then stop it, then change its parameters, because they believed unanimously in their power to do it right and correctly. We can overcome groupthink again by making the group small, by encourage group leaders to actively seek input from all group members, and particularly those who may have a different viewpoint. This is what we not often do in groups. Sometimes a devil's advocate may help, but I put a careful and exclamation mark next to it, because I think that a devil's advocate sometimes raises the group members, the other group members' feelings that they are right. So sometimes the devil's advocate is seen as an out-group member who even increases cohesiveness and may lead to higher groupthink. And I put a large but to it. Heslam and colleagues in JOB have shown that, yes, groups in which group members identify highly with pursue the course of action for a longer time, even if there are some signs of problems. See the Berlin airport, for example. Even if there were early signs of problems, highly cohesive and identified groups pursue the course of action for a longer time. But it depends on the case we are working and on the issue that is at stake, whether this is a good or a bad thing. And only hindsight tells us whether it was good to build the Cologne Dome for 400 years and to invest billions of Goldmark and Deutschmark into it. Today, no one would say, let's tear it down again. It took too long to build it. And maybe we say the same thing about the Elbphilharmonie in Hamburg or the Berlin airport. Heslam and colleagues did research in the laboratory about building a kindergarten. And those groups in which there was higher identification stuck to their aim, even if there were some signs, yeah, the kindergarten may be more expensive in the end than was originally thought. Yeah, but maybe it's a good cause to build a kindergarten. And maybe it's good to have some commitment and identification in the group to pursue this cause and not to give up when there are the first obstacles. So all I want to say is that groupthink is a phenomenon that we have to consider in the real world, but groupthink may not necessarily be only negative. It sounds negative, but it can also have some positive effects to have cohesive groups. Yeah, thank you very much. See you next week.